Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. In 2007, the museum at Eldred Street opened at the site of a restored 19th century synagogue originally built by some of the first Eastern European Jewish immigrants in New York City. In Beyond the Synagogue, Jewish Nostalgia as Religious Practice, published by New York University Press in 2021, Rachel B. Gross argues that nostalgic activities such as visiting the museum at Eldred Street or eating traditional Jewish foods should be understood as American Jewish religious practices. Tracing American Jews' involvement in a broad array of ostensibly non-religious activities, including conducting Jewish genealogical research, visiting Jewish historic sites, purchasing books and toys that teach Jewish nostalgia to children, and seeking out traditional Jewish foods, Gross argues that these practices illuminate how many American Jews are finding and making meaning within American Judaism. Rachel B. Gross is assistant professor and John and Marcia Goldman Chair in American Jewish Studies in the Department of Jewish Studies at San Francisco State University. I'm so glad her new book has brought her to our program. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Zalman. I'm so glad to be here.
So to get started, please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work.
Yeah, so this book began as my dissertation, and before that, it has its roots in my master's thesis at the University of Virginia. And I was really interested in studying more or less ordinary Jews' lives. I don't know if there's a category of ordinary Jew, but I was interested in what people were doing in their daily lives. And I was really interested in the spaces that they were creating, the kind of community spaces that Jews were using, and especially in museums. And you can hear that at the top when you describe the museum at Eldridge Street. I was really interested in historic synagogues that were used as museums and what it meant for them to be both museums and synagogues, which on the face of it seem like really different kinds of spaces. And one of my professors gave me the image of a one of those images that are like black and white images. And if you look at it one way, it's a woman. And if you look at it the other way, it's a duck or something, right? So it's like, is it a synagogue? Is it a museum? Is it a synagogue? It's a museum. It's both, right? So it's like, what's going on in these spaces? And I wrote my master's thesis on these weird spaces that were both. And from that, continued on to my PhD at Princeton in the Department of Religion, and realized what I was actually really interested in. I didn't feel like I was done with these synagogues that were used as museums, but I was really interested in the emotion that people were feeling and the stories people were feeling in these spaces. And from there, I decided that the emotion I thought they were feeling in these spaces was nostalgia, especially for the story of Central and Eastern European Jews, the largest immigration of Jews to the United States, who came to the Ashkenazi Jews from Central and Eastern Europe, who came to the United States between the 1880s and 1924. And Jews who came to these spaces in the late 20th and early 21st centuries really wanted to feel a longing for that time period of emotion, wanted to feel a connection to that time. And ultimately, I ended up studying a variety of institutional organizations, of institutions and organizations that developed and I think cultivated that feeling in American Jews. So I ended up looking at Jewish genealogists, the historic synagogues used as museums, children's books and dolls, and finally some restaurants and other Jewish foodways. And in the book, I look at how all of these practices and institutions related to them encourage Jews to feel a nostalgia for this particular moment at the turn of the century. And I make the argument, because I'm a religious studies scholar, I make the argument that that is religion.
Right, right. Well, thank you for laying that out. To step back a drop, you talk in the book about how Jewish leaders and sociologists often worry about the Jewish continuity crisis, and you argue that those Jewish leaders and sociologists that are concerned about this Jewish continuity crisis are really missing something important about the life and practice of American Jews. Well, what is it exactly that they're missing, and why are they missing it, so to speak?
Yeah, thanks for that question. As I say in the book, I think a lot of the sociologists and other Jewish community leaders who are thinking about a Jewish American Jewish continuity crisis are looking for Judaism in the wrong places. they're mostly looking for Judaism, like really Jewish religious practice, in synagogues and in what some folks call Jewish legacy institutions. So along with synagogues, Jewish community centers get lumped in there, Jewish federations, which are the major vehicle of Jewish philanthropy, get lumped in there. These are recognizably Jewish religious institutions in some way. And the heyday of those institutions was really the 1950s, which was really the heyday of institutionalized religion in the United States in general, beyond Jews. And I think, and I'm certainly not the only Jewish studies scholar or American religious history scholar to say this, but we should start thinking of the 1950s not as a model for American religion and American Judaism, but really as an anomaly, that American religion and American Judaism was having a weird moment when a lot of people were going to synagogue, a lot of people were going to church, and that was actually pretty unusual. And I think that American Jews are might think of themselves as people who are maybe less institutional now. I actually think they're still hugely institutionally minded, but they're interested in other types of institutions. So I think I don't see Jewish continuity or really, I don't love the word continuity, but I don't see Jewish religion or practice or community in crisis. I see it flourishing in all kinds of different places. And the kinds of different places I've been looking have been, again, Jewish genealogical societies, historic synagogues that are used as museums, in the institutions around children's books and in family practices around children's books and dolls, and in restaurants like delis. And what makes these institutions different is that from the other kind of institution, from the synagogues and federations, maybe different from those, arguably, is that you can devote your life to them, right? You can be a Jewish genealogist who spends her whole, really devotes her life full time to doing Jewish genealogy. Or you can pop in once to a Jewish genealogy Facebook group or pop on once to Ancestry.com. And I don't think that popping in once to these institutions or these networks makes them any less meaningful in people's lives. I think that that these structures, these networks, these institutions still really help people have a narrative that helps them understand themselves in history and in relation to a broader community.
Right. And so just to go back to these sociologists, and maybe because I'm a sociologist, so I find your book has so many fascinating aspects, but this is one of them that really sticks out for me. So I would assume that the religious Jewish leaders that you're alluding to and the Jewish sociologists are aware of the kinds of practices that you are focusing on. Just they would consider them Jewish cultural practices and you consider them Jewish religious practices, right? Is that fair to assume?
I think yes and no, but yeah.
I was just going to say that assuming that's the case, what would you say is gained by describing these specifically as religious practices rather than quote unquote merely Jewish cultural practices?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for that question. The reason I would say yes and no to begin with is certainly they're aware that these things exist. I think that the things I'm looking at haven't been measured in the community studies and in the national studies that have been done of American Jews, most notably, of course, the 2013 Pew study of American Jews. So my understanding as a sociologist, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I've seen, the community studies and the national studies of Jews don't tend to ask about these kinds of cultural practices. And what's interesting to me, I really wish they would. That would be helpful to me, and I think to many other folks studying Jews. There was a Baltimore community study many years ago that actually did measure Jews' museum attendance. It was very unusual. I haven't seen that on any other community study. And what was really interesting to me was that Jews were doing it at really rates, the same rate across the board. That it was something that I don't remember what the rate was. It was maybe 50% or something. I'm making that up. But the rate held basically constant across people who identified as conservative, Orthodox, Reform, non-affiliated with a denomination. And that's really interesting. Like that's something that I think is pretty unusual, right? And that tells us like this is a constant across Jews. So that's one thing. And then to your question, about like what's gained by calling this religious, which is like really like what are we doing as religious studies scholars? I find religion a really fruitful word. Maybe I have to say that because that's how I make my living. But I think of religion, you know, we all got to defend our living at this point. I think of religion really broadly. How Judaism fits into religion is a long history, that Judaism often fits uncomfortably into our standard definitions of religion, in part because our standard definitions of religion were created by Protestants. So Judaism sometimes works like Protestantism and sometimes it doesn't. I'm really drawn to expansive definitions of religion that religious studies scholars do. I especially like the way that Robert Orsi thinks about religion as networks of relationships between that can include relationships between living people, between people and the divine, between people and sacred figures. Sometimes that happens in Judaism, sometimes it doesn't. Between people and their ancestors, all kinds of different meaningful relationships, and the texts and the practices and the stories that support all of these kinds of relationships. And we can highlight some of these relationships at certain times, and sometimes we don't. And I think using religion in this way and thinking about it really expansively helps us think ultimately about what's meaningful in people's lives and the ways that they form meaning as individuals, as families, and as communities. And to me, as a religious studies scholar, Like, that's at the heart of what I want to do. I want to find out what is meaningful to people. And I think that the way that sociologists of American Jews have been studying religion, and really like the Pew study divided people into Jews by religion and Jews of no religion, right? They're thinking about religion, but they're thinking of religion in a really narrow way that I think is missing the places and the practices where Jews are finding meaning as individuals and as part of broader communities.
Right.
And that matters. And that matters because I think just in people's lives, and it matters in terms of how American Jews distribute money also. Like, ultimately, these studies matter for philanthropic purposes as well, as well as how we understand ourselves.
Yeah. Right. So there's definitely a good deal riding on kind of the definition or the framing of the concept of religion as it relates to the Jewish community in America. You mentioned about meaning making, and I'm just curious, does it matter if some of the people that are involved in the practices that you're talking about may not describe themselves as being engaged in a quote religious ritual or religious practice? Like, is that significant for your understanding or your analysis of what's going on there?
Yeah. And that's that might or might not be a difference between a social scientist and a humanities scholar. Ultimately, I think of my work, I'm naming things both as nostalgic and as religious. And my subjects often might not think of their work as nostalgic and as religious. Ultimately, I think I'm offering them words that can be used as tools to help them understand their worlds. So I certainly do my best to be respectful of the work they do and respectful of the ways that they understand their work. And some of the folks that I interviewed, just dozens and dozens of people, and observed many more. And some of them told me that they appreciated the language I was using. Some of them told me, "That's nice, Rachel, but like, that's not the word I'd use." And ultimately, that's fine with me. Some of them, I will say, do use this language. I did speak to a prominent Jewish genealogist who describes his work as a mitzvah and uses pretty religious terms to do so. He says it's a mitzvah.
And a mitzvah is a Jewish commandment.
Yes, thank you. He says it's a Jewish commandment, like a religiously a commandment for a number of specific reasons. He connects it to traditional commandments such as honor your parents, which he extends to honor your ancestors, and a number of other traditional commandments. And I take that a step further than he does. And I say, okay, this whole thing, this whole engaging with longing for this particular story of American Jewish immigration can be understood as a mitzvah in American Jewish life. So some of them like it, and some of them say, okay, I would use the word spiritual, but not religious. Okay, I think that gets to the different ways that American Jews and other Americans use language. But ultimately, I think of this book as, first of all, I'm having a conversation among other academics, but insofar as I hope any of my interlocutors will read this book, I think of these tools as offering something to them, which sure, they can take or leave.
Sure, as of course any scholar studying anything, you know, we come up with models and insights that we hope, we pray, people out there in the broader society will embrace and appreciate. And obviously it's up to them to figure out what to do with it, of course. You mentioned the word nostalgia. What do you mean by nostalgia?
So I think of nostalgia as a sentimental longing for an irrevocable past, which is a definition that I both like, and also it makes me laugh every time, because I think the fundamental aspect of the past is that it is, in fact, irrevocable, right? That's how time works. But But the deal with nostalgia is that you're really longing for the past. You're really you're sad. You're a little bit bittersweet sad about the past, and that longing, that consciousness that the past cannot be reclaimed or returned to, is you're really conscious of that moment, and it's both comforting, I think, in some ways that we can't go back to the past, but also it's really bittersweet. So it's that longing for the past.
Right. And specifically in the context of your study, the past that American Jews feel such strong nostalgia for is the Jewish immigration, the Eastern European Jewish immigration to America in the early 1900s. That's really the period in Jewish history that you feel so many contemporary American Jews are longing to connect to.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I think they're not just longing for it. Individuals are longing for this moment, sure. But what I'm interested in is how many institutions are teaching them to feel longing for this moment people might feel that way about their own families. Certainly I see that in the Jewish genealogists I look at. But this is a standardized narrative that American Jews are being taught to feel. And what's so interesting about that is that's going to include American Jews whose families had this particular experience, as most American Jewish families do have this history. And it's going to include people who didn't have this experience. So because it's a standardized story, American Jews who have Sephardi backgrounds from Spanish and Portuguese descent, Mizrahi Jews from Middle Eastern descent, and other Jews who might or might not have Jewish ancestry are all being taught relating to this particular history is how you are an American Jew.
Right. That really is fascinating. I mean, you talk about the boundaries of this nostalgia that on the one hand, it's fairly expansive, it's fairly kind of fluid and flexible. And at the same time, there are limits to it. And as you were just saying, some things that are sort of apparently or logically beyond the limits of this nostalgia or of this history still kind of get folded into it. And one thing that really I thought was so a fascinating example was about the adoptee who was adopted by a Jewish family and then was told that she should adopt her Jewish ancestry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. When I was really interested in people who write Jewish genealogy manuals. They're really writing the script for Jewish genealogy. And I asked a number of them, like, what do you tell adoptees? And you know, looked at what they write in their books. And they said, yeah, you know, absolutely, you should as an adoptee, or I think the same would go for Jews by choice. You should absolutely study your own family history, whether that's your biological family history, your adopted family history, but you should also be interested in this mainstream narrative of Ashkenazi Jews, right? And what I think about when I think about Jewish genealogy, what makes genealogy different from academic history is, I think, the emotion that you are emotionally placing yourself in this history. You know, many genealogists are really fabulous researchers and have done a lot of archival work, have helped set up archives that many academic historians benefit from. And what's different, I think, about the work they're doing is that there's is ultimately an emotional project and is ultimately about emotionally placing themselves in the story, which makes their work different, but certainly not better or worse, but I think just different from academic historians' work.
Right. And I'm curious, obviously this nostalgia for this particular time in Jewish history clearly, you know, began after this period in Jewish history. As you were saying before, you could, by definition, you could only have nostalgia for something once it has already passed. But was there a particular period when this nostalgic movement sort of developed? And if so, why? What was going on around that time that contributed to this movement beginning?
Yeah, thank you for that question to help me place this story in time. I think about this kind of institutionalized American Jewish nostalgia beginning in the 1970s, and I look at it from the 1970s to the present. In the 1960s and 1970s, we have the what's called the American Roots Movement, particularly when African Americans were thinking about African American history in new ways and trying to write African American history in new ways. We get Roots, the book and the miniseries of that name. And starting in the 1970s, white folks start saying, hey, thinking about our family histories in similar ways is a really interesting idea. And in particular, in the 1970s, we get what we sometimes call white ethnics, start the people of Irish, Italian, and Ashkenazi Jewish descent.
Ashkenazi is Eastern European Jews.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you. So Jews of Eastern European descent and Italians and Irish all look around and say, we didn't used to be considered white, but like by the 1970s, we're pretty much considered white. And maybe we're a little bit uncomfortable with that, right? We want to tell a story of our distinctiveness, even as our whiteness has been beneficial to us and our families on the whole. So one way to do that is to tell stories of family history, is to get really into genealogy. Just as African Americans were getting into genealogy, which is sometimes a very difficult thing for African Americans, these white ethnic folks started getting into genealogy. And Ashkenazi Jews in the 1970s started contending with how difficult it is to do, or was especially, to do Eastern European Jewish history, and that it required a certain set of skills. It required language skills. At the time, it required the difficulty of doing research in the Soviet Union in many cases. And they started forming groups. They started forming Jewish genealogical societies. They started networking really on the internet as the internet itself was growing, right? Jewish genealogy has, I think genealogy in general actually is very much a story of, has always been a story of the internet. And I interviewed folks who got in on the internet very early as they tried to create Jewish genealogy networks in that way, as they tried to pool their resources. So that's the 1970s. And I think this effort to think about American Jewish histories, family histories, and community histories continued. In the 1980s, folks started looking around at historic synagogues and saying, what are we going to do with these buildings, which in some cases had been either abandoned or congregations had dwindled, especially in urban areas. In the mid 20th century, many American Jews, like these other white ethnics, had moved out of cities into the suburbs. So their former synagogues in cities were left, the buildings were left, and by the 1980s, folks started looking around thinking about what are we going to do with these buildings? Are we going to present them to the public in some way? In the 1990s, the Jewish children's book industry really starts taking off with the advent of multiculturalism in some ways. Jewish children's books had been developing throughout the 20th century. But by the 1990s, mainstream publishers start thinking about wanting a Hanukkah book in a public school classroom. And the Jewish publishing industry or Jews authoring and in some cases illustrating books about Jewish history starts to develop. And that really gets a push with the organization PJ Library, which we can talk about or not in the early 2000s.
Yeah, sure. But I want to just go back for a second about the Jewish genealogy. So what exactly were people doing when you with these genealogical efforts? Like, what did it look like on the ground when they were getting together or communicating on the internet or through computers? What exactly were they trying to do, and to what extent did they succeed at doing it?
Yeah, I think, well, on the ground, in terms of the practical stuff, that could look like a whole lot of things. So that could look like, how do I get records from Ellis Island about my immigrants, about my ancestors' immigration papers? How do we sort through, or how do we access city records, right? So really nitty gritty stuff in that way. And also the nitty gritty stuff of how do I read handwriting? How do I translate things that might be in other languages? How do we connect between, and the work of connecting family members, right? Which all of these kind of practices are going to look really different. I think really from decade to decade, sometimes from year to year as technology changes. And the work they're doing also, I think the work that I'm interested in is how are they telling stories about this, right? Because they're also telling themselves increasingly, like literally giving talks to each other and writing this. They're creating newsletters and forming groups, telling each other to form groups, writing newsletters about how they should form groups. And I think in the process of doing this, they're figuring out how to tell their stories, right? And how to tell their stories to each other, how to tell their stories to their family members, how to tell their stories to anybody who will listen. If you've ever encountered a Jewish genealogist, bless them. All they want is somebody to listen to their stories. God bless. I was honored to listen to many family histories in this research. And I think they're finding their place, I think, in Jewish history and community.
Right. And what kinds of stories are they telling? Like, did they ascribe certain characteristics to their ancestors, or certain, ideas about what drove their ancestors to come to America, or the kind of life that they created once they arrived?
Yeah. So they're often finding commonalities between themselves and their ancestors, which is something that I find really delightful among Jewish genealogists. So folks who are into art might say, hey, I had an ancestor who was an artist. That must be where it comes from. Or folks who are scientists, you know, and that's so lovely, like that you can place yourself in history, that you can see a connection between yourself and your ancestors. Like, what amazing meaning-making work that is, even if it might not be like exactly historically accurate, or like that might not be, I don't know how artistic talent works. Maybe that is how it works. But they're really placing themselves in this history, and they're telling a story. Ultimately, American Jews, like other white folks in the United States, are telling a story of success in the United States. So they're telling stories about how their ancestors at the turn of the century really struggled, and throughout the 20th century, they generally became more prosperous. And now American Jews are looking around and saying, hey, what does it mean to be an American Jew who's often, certainly not all Jews in the United States are well off, but many of them are telling stories about how they're better off than their ancestors. And this is, it's such an interesting story. Like, this is where nostalgia is so interesting to me, because it's not just nostalgia for the good old days, like that my ancestors had it so great. It's that my ancestors really struggled, that it was really painful for them, that they're telling in the children's books I look at, they're telling stories about like it being physically dirty, you know, and it, like stories of hardship. And it's that longing for the days when things were hard, but there's the but, that we had each other, we had family, right? So there's that contrast and that worry that that maybe that connection to family and community and whatever Jewishness is might be lost and can be reclaimed through this longing, through this nostalgic longing for what the ancestors had.
Sure. And so tell us a little bit about the PJ Library and how it fits into this project.
Oh, I am obsessed with PJ Library. I think they are the most interesting Jewish institution out there, completely understudied. PJ Library is an institution that partners with local Jewish institutions to send free books and music to Jewish and interfaith to Jewish and interfaith families with children once a month. So you can sign up through a local institution and like a synagogue or a JCC, and once a month a family will receive books or music that's age appropriate for their Jewish or interfaith kid. And they are explicitly interested in shaping the American Jewish family, right? And and getting to them at their most tender, intimate moments, the moments of like bedtime, the moments of, I don't have kids, but I hear from folks who have kids that like, that's the moment when you're exhausted and you like, you're just reaching for something to put your kid to bed. And like, don't worry, PJ Library's there, and they're there with a story that will connect you to what they think is the way you should be shaping your family's Jewish practices and the way that your family understands their Judaism. And they are like, they, unlike maybe some of these mainstream sociological studies, they are doing their own sociological studies of Jewish families, and they are finding proof that that I find quite convincing that they are shaping Jewish families. So the books that I looked at in my book were all distributed by PJ Library. They were all books. PJ Library is involved in encouraging new books on subjects that they find important. And they also reprint previously published books in a paperback form to distribute to families. So the books that I looked at were all previously published children's books on Eastern European Jewish immigration history and were distributed by PJ Library. So PJ Library does not only distribute books about Eastern European Jewish immigration history, but those are the ones from their collection that I looked at.
Yeah. Sure. And how Jewish are these books?
Very Jewish. In PJ Library in general, or the books in my book?
Well, both. I mean, and obviously when I say Jewish, I mean sort of how much Jewish content, Jewish knowledge, Jewish content is conveyed in these books.
So the books I'm looking at in my book are all stories about this moment of immigration history, and they are they're explicitly about Jews immigrating at this moment. And PJ Library adds helpfully to me, I extremely helpful to a researcher. They add they have reading guides for parents, and they tell parents what they like to get out of these books. So I look at a book called I look at Sheldon Obermann's The Always Prayer Shawl, for instance, which is I think a beautiful book that tells the story of a boy from Russia, presumably around the turn of the 20th century, who has a relationship with his grandfather, but his family leaves Russia for North America. Side note, Sheldon Obermann was actually Canadian and wrote a generically North American story so it could be published for audiences in the United States as well, which I hear is an extremely Canadian thing to do. it's very smart. So this little boy, his grandfather gives him his prayer shawl when he leaves Russia and comes to North America. And the boy grows up and ultimately has a relationship with his own grandson and promises to give his grandson the prayer shawl as well. And there's a bit about the name Adam being passed along the generations as well. I find it a very moving story. I don't find all the children's books I look at moving, but this one I found very, very moving. And the illustrations are really stunning. And PJ Library, I believe, unless I'm confusing it with another book at this point, but PJ Library says, they'll say something like, talk to your children about where your ancestors come from, and also talk to them about different kinds of value, including sentimental value, which, like, that's amazing for me. Yes, yes. Talk to children about emotions and the ways that objects connect us to previous generations, the way we tell stories, and the ways that we communicate value through these family connections. So that's really lovely. And I think it's supposed to be a model, you know. I think PJ is distributing this book because it's supposed to be a model. You're supposed to have either, you're supposed to imagine a relationship with ancestors in this way. Yeah, I think that's one thing that comes up in children's books a lot, actually. And actually, Sheldon Overman said this himself, that he didn't have such a great relationship with his own grandparents. But he said, even if you didn't know your grandparents, you knew what you wanted from them. So I'm really interested in these books in imaginary grandparents, which are sometimes, I think, more poignant, certainly easier to deal with sometimes than real life grandparents. Which is to say, imaginary people are easier to deal with than real people. Not a slight against grandparents.
Right. No, I totally get that. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And if you're able to, if someone who is adopted by a Jewish family is able to adopt the ancestry of the family that adopted them, so too, you know, Jewish children could imagine the grandparents that they would like to have, even if they're somewhat different than the Pubby and Zadie that they personally know.
Exactly.
It's really a fascinating idea. To go back to the synagogues, what are some examples of historical synagogues that you look at? And what are some of the creative ways that people are interacting with them through this nostalgic process?
Yeah, so I'll tell you about my favorite story, my favorite story from my research, which takes place at the museum at Eldridge Street, with which we began this conversation. The museum at Eldridge Street is located in a historic synagogue from 1887, if I have that date right, on the Lower East Side in Lower Manhattan. And they describe themselves as the first synagogue building built from the ground up by Eastern European immigrants. So Eastern European immigrants would meet in many different kinds of places, but this was the grand synagogue, the first grand synagogue they built on the Lower East Side when they arrived there. And over the course of the 20th century, in the 1970s, 80s, and so it fell into disrepair as Jews had left the Lower East Side and which had once been a thriving immigrant neighborhood, including a Jewish immigrant neighborhood. So by the late 80s, by the 1990s, it still had a congregation, actually. It always had a congregation that continued to meet there, but they met in the basement, and the grand sanctuary had been shut up for quite some time. The beautiful stained glass windows had been destroyed. Pigeons were flying in and out, and all the mess that that New York City can wreck on a place. In the 1990s and into the early 2000s, preservationists worked very hard to restore to renovate the building, restore its former glory, and thought really carefully about the ways in which it should be restored and what should be preserved and what should be left. Today, or, you know, when the pandemic abates and you can go again to such buildings, tourists can go to visit this synagogue. And the congregation continues to meet, but during the week it operates as a museum. That's how they think about that that woman in Giacomo. And they will sit down, tourists will sit down in the pews of the Grand Sanctuary and listen to the story of how the synagogue was shut up and now it was restored. Now it's beautiful and they can look around. Like, that's great. They can look around and see how beautiful it is. And at the end of this story, the docent, almost always a woman, the docent will lead the tourists out towards the back to continue the tour into other rooms. And she stops right at the back of the sanctuary where the museum has moved away some of the pews. And she'll say, you know, you see how the floorboard is kind of wavy? Step into the indentations in the floorboards. And they will, they'll find themselves lining up in straight lines. And the docent will say, why do you think you've all lined up in straight lines? And maybe someone will realize, or maybe she'll explain to them that they are standing literally in the footprints of past congregants, that they're in lines because men, this was a gender segregated space, and this was the men's space, and men standing in front of their pews had rocked back and forth as they prayed in the traditional Jewish fashion, and they'd worn grooves into the soft pine floorboards so that now you, tourists, are able to literally stand in their footprints. And I love this moment. It's so powerful. It takes that longing for the past and it takes all that emotion of being in this place and hearing the story and makes it so immediate and embodied. And it's always like, you know, a lot of this research I looked at, in addition to going on many, many tours, I read a lot of Yelp reviews of these places, and it's always mentioned in the Yelp reviews as well. And I just think that's such a smart moment of public history that incorporates the body and emotion and storytelling and the physical structure of the synagogue in such a smart way.
Wow, it really is very powerful. When I read that in the book, I got chills. I also totally got sucked into that moment just by reading about it. Speaking of embodiment and how that plays a role in these nostalgic or nostalgia practices, you talk about Jewish culinary nostalgia. What are some examples of Jewish culinary nostalgia, and how does that play out in people's lives?
Yeah, so I was interested not just in traditional Jewish delis in particular, but by the early 2000s, we've reached a moment when folks are starting to look around at the nostalgic Jewish stories that have been told and at the ways those have been told in food, and started to reevaluate them and started to play with them, to get really playful with them, and also to think about how delis and other Jewish food institutions didn't necessarily reflect the values that they had as culinary entrepreneurs. So I'm really interested in what sometimes called hipster or artisanal delis and other types of food businesses that think about Jewish Ashkenazi, Eastern European, and Central European Jewish food histories and the ways they developed in the United States, and taking those traditions and bringing them into the 21st century with food values such as thinking about local food, thinking about sustainability, and those kind of practices. And the folks I look at do that work with a lot of humor as well. So they were a lot of fun to study. So, it was a really interesting project to study these folks, because on the one hand, they're continuing the work that I saw in my other case studies. They're thinking very much about their family histories. I thought about Mile End Deli in New York. I didn't only look at New York places, but these are my some of my favorite examples. But Mile End Deli is in Brooklyn as well as Manhattan. And the founder there really thought about his own family history, his Canadian family history, Mile End, named after the Montreal, the Lower East Side of Montreal, I think is maybe a United States-centric way of describing it. But he really thought about his grandmother's cooking and what it meant to update his grandmother's cooking and share his family history with others. And so folks are thinking about their own family histories and really, really working through that through food. And at the same time, they're placing themselves, again, in this broader story of American Jewish food history. And what I'm interested there is the ways that restaurants are sites of public history, or they can be sites of public history, that we don't necessarily think of them in that way. But they tell the smart ones, I think, or the most thoughtful ones tell us a food story. And they might do so through their menus. They might do so through the ways they describe themselves. And that customers can place themselves in that story, that many Jewish customers and non-Jewish customers, actually, walk into a deli and think about all the other times they've had a pastrami sandwich with their family and all the times that makes them think about their family histories. So I think there's a lot of narrative work going on there.
All right. And I was really, I don't know if tickled is the right word, but it was very interesting to me to see that there was a Kutcher's in Tribeca, obviously named after and related to the famous Kutcher's resort in the Catskills, upstate New York. So there were linkages that were trying to be established.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Kutcher's Tribeca is no longer in existence. Some of the places that I wrote about when I did this research in the 2010s are no longer in existence.
I did see that and I was very saddened. Actually, I had very big, ambitious plans for me and Kutcher's Tribeca. Is there a sense of, you mentioned that some of the establishments closed down. You mentioned that the Gefilteria is still a success and that Wise Sons Jewish Deli has 5 locations now. So some of these establishments seem to have thrived and others, not so much. Do you think it was just based on the kind of the individual businesses or the local economy, or do you think it says something about this aspect of Jewish nostalgia that maybe it's not as sustainable as some other areas that you explore?
That's a really interesting question. Thank you for that. I think sometimes some restaurants just close, and certainly I think especially I looked at a number of food trucks in the Midwest. Those are no longer in existence. I think the food truck story and maybe Kutcher's Tribeca are places where restaurateurs tried things out. So I don't know that I haven't talked to the owners, but I don't know that that's always, I don't know that we as people analyzing them should necessarily think of them as failures, especially places like food trucks or places where people can try things out at kind of a lower risk. And a certain percentage of restaurants fail. So I don't think that this means that this concept is over. And in fact, By this moment, by the time of the pandemic, I've been really interested to hear from deli owners and folks like the Gefilteria who are purveyors of artisanal gefilte fish and other old world foods, as they say, that if they made it to the pandemic, actually, they're still struggling. It's very, very hard to be in the food business in the pandemic. And I don't want to minimize that, but they are actually in one of the food categories that has been doing well in the pandemic, because people actually do want comfort food this year. And deli food, Ashkenazi, Eastern European, Central European Jewish food, is a comfort food for many people. So I hear that from the folks at Wise Sons and a couple of other places that that their online orders have been doing quite well, and their difficulties that they've encountered in the pandemic are the difficulties of keeping a restaurant open in the pandemic, not that there isn't an audience for it. Yeah.
Fascinating. Wow. I'm curious, is Jewish nostalgia a gendered phenomenon?
Ooh, yes. Love this question. Thank you. So first of all, no, not necessarily. I think that the folks I'm looking at really ended up like naturally being men and women, people of all genders, and kind of an even gender spread. Sometimes folks assume that I'm looking primarily at men or looking primarily at women, and it was really pretty even. When I went back and started by the end of working on this book, I was giving a lot of presentations about it already, and I found a difference in the ways that people thought about my work, actually. And when I presented my work at a Jewish genealogical society here where I am in San Francisco, the men in the group tended to push back. They did not necessarily love hearing that their work was emotional. They didn't disagree with my research, but they didn't love the way I was describing their work as emotional or as religious. But the women in the group tended to say, "You're naming something that we hadn't quite been able to articulate." So there's that difference. In the food industry, I think there are gender dynamics at play in each of the case studies that I look at. In the museum world, there tends to be gender differences at different levels. In the restaurant world, it's very hard to run a restaurant and be in the restaurant business as a woman. And there's plenty of work out there describing that. The women in the restaurant chapter, in my restaurant chapter, tend to be running businesses with men. And I think that's a reflection just of how difficult the restaurant business is for women in general. So I would say, yeah, so there's definitely gender dynamics going on in every way, but because we live in a world with gender differences, not because nostalgia itself is particularly gendered.
Great answer. all right, well, last question. Looking forward, speaking sort of the opposite of nostalgia, could you tell us about any new project that you're working on now?
Yeah, so I have grand plans someday. I think in the future, I'd like to continue this work and think about do-it-yourself Judaism and the institutions like PJ Library, as well as a couple of other institutions that I think encourage American Jews who are their constituents to think about how they're doing Judaism on their own, but are really giving them the tools and directing their Jewish lives in particular ways, in the ways that PJ Library is handing Jewish families books. I'm not emotionally ready to take on that project yet. As a religious studies scholar, I need to take a brief break from living Jews, which as a sociologist, perhaps you understand. I need to study some Jews in the past in the meantime. And I'm just at the beginning of a project in which I want to think about the immigration story that I've looked at in this book and think about where did it come from? So I want to look at, I want to write a religious biography of the immigration writer Mary Anton, who was a really popular immigration writer in the 1910s. She had a brief moment of fame, and she's still remembered and beloved by like people who teach literature classes on immigration memoirs and very few other people. But she actually had a really interesting and complicated religious life that complicates, she had a complicated relationship to being a Jew and explored a lot of other religions. So I want to think about that immigration narrative in the life of this one particular woman.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for these questions.
Well, that concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.